The Health Commission.
Thanks.
We would like to welcome everybody here and in our audience and also our commissioners. And we'll call this meeting to order. And first on the agenda are the minutes from the March 14th meeting. Do we have any comments or corrections?
I'll move approval.
Second.
The Health Commission. All in favor? Thank you. Those have been approved as read.
We would like welcome everybody.
We are now to public comment.
Audience and also
and I believe we have some
and
folks
we'll
in the audience
to order.
For
and
public comment.
First on the agenda are the minutes from the March 14th meeting. Do we have any comments or corrections?
I'll move approval.
The Health Commission. All in favor?
Good evening. My name is Lisa Fraser. I direct the San Luis Obispo County Child Abuse Prevention Council. It's a nonprofit agency that's been functioning here in San Luis Obispo County since 1987. And I'm just here to promote and remind the commissioners that April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month. And we continue to serve the county with a variety of prevention education projects. And what I do want to remind the
Good
commission
evening.
Today.
My name is Lisa Fraser. I direct the San Luis Obispo County Child Abuse Prevention Council. It's a nonprofit agency that's been functioning here in San Luis Obispo County since 1987.
Well, shall I just
and I'm just here to.
I guess it stopped. So what I would like to remind the commission that the substantiated child abuse and neglect rates in our county. That ages 0 to 3 suffered the highest rates of victimization compared to all the other age groups and continue to be that way, not just in this county, but it's a state and a national statistic. So children that are ages birth to 3 years cannot speak for themselves. They can't tell us. Therefore, when they are in a situation where there's domestic violence and substance abuse issues, this is where they suffer the greatest. So I would like to hand my public comment over to Mary Bianchi because we would like to inform the commission about our concerns about Martha's Place and its place in our community and services for 0 to 5 children who are specially needing services because of their high-risk environment in their home. So thank you.
Thank you. My name is Mary Bianchi. I'm a resident of Atascadero. I'm chair of the Model of Care Partners Oversight Committee and also a member of the Friends of Martha's Place. And I'm here to share with the commission some information regarding our most vulnerable residents, those children ages 0 to 5. There are programs, luckily, here in the county that are focused on the physical health of our children. Unfortunately, very few focus on their mental health, particularly during those formative years 0 to 5, when our children develop their capacity to experience, express and regulate their emotions, form close and secure relationships, and explore the environment and learn. Some of our local programs do evaluate children for this last component, and you'll hear it described as school readiness. And school readiness is important, but for these children to be successful, they also have to be ready for life. Those years from 0 to 5 are not a rehearsal. But are the real show. Unfortunately, children 0 to 5, as Lisa was mentioning, have disproportionately high rates of child abuse, and the consequences of this early trauma can include traumatic stress, depression, anxiety, conduct disorder, learning problems, and substance abuse that all lead to significant long-term consequences for their mental and physical health. Unfortunately, these children have oftentimes been overlooked by our mental health system despite being entitled to these services. Why do these problems happen? These children are oftentimes understood by their parents and caregivers. Their behaviors can be difficult to understand and address, and this can often lead to child abuse, at-risk behaviors, not being ready for Tanner School, or being kicked out of daycare or preschool, and multiple foster placements. We also have compelling evidence that early intervention improves the lives of these children and their families. And thanks to the vision of leaders in our community, our youngest and most vulnerable children have been provided with the means to change the stage on which their life is developing. Through the services provided by the amazing multidisciplinary team at Martha's Place, Martha's Place is focused on providing a multidisciplinary assessment of the mental health and health needs for children 0 to 5 and is the only provider of this service in our community. Martha's Place provides full assessment and appropriate treatment services and referrals for these children 0 to 5 that can help the family and other parties involved with them better understand and identify the children's needs and can help caregivers access services that are needed for the children in order to ensure their healthy development emotionally, cognitively, and physically. I want to share a brief story from Martha's Place. Today, our special child is a 3-year-old, happy, fully functional little girl. But at 21 months, she was socially detached, nonverbal, and did not seek out either the attention or comfort of others. Prenatal exposure to alcohol, opiates, and methamphetamines, and exposure to domestic violence had left her living in foster care. Through the efforts of the multidisciplinary team at Martha's Place, she is now with caregivers who understand and can address her behaviors and are connected to the resources and solutions she will need to progress. She's less likely to require intervention from law enforcement or by the Department of Social Services because of child abuse. With supportive adoptive parents, she's less likely to re-enter the foster care system and more likely to be school-ready. Neither she nor her caregivers are as likely to require ongoing mental health services, drug and alcohol services, or special education services. She's less likely to become part of the juvenile dependency or delinquency system or require probation. For these reasons, economic analysis demonstrates that for every dollar invested in early childhood intervention, a savings of $3 to $17 can be expected. Current service level reductions proposals from the County Health Agency, in addition to reductions from funding from First Five, suggest that the Martha's Place budget could be reduced by as much as 60%. Research and recommendations published by the American Psychological Association in its February issue emphasizes the importance of early intervention and the impact that it has in saving money and time, as well as helping our communities. Support of the multidisciplinary assessments at Martha's Place ensure those early intervention dollars are targeted and effective. Our little girl is now a safe and healthy child who, with her family, may learn and grow to their full potential in a supportive community. I know that each of you want the same for all of our most vulnerable children and ask that the Health Commission continue to support Martha's Place and the delivery of these critical services in our community. Thank you for your attention.
I just had one comment. I don't know, Mary, if you saw the article in the paper about the number of babies that it's increasing that have to be detoxed from pain medications, the opiates. And these babies are literally having to be detoxed at birth.
And just to comment, those are the types of children that can be helped at Martha's Place because certainly while they may have the opiates out of their system, there are significant impacts from that prenatal exposure to opiates where interventions can really help that child to develop normally. Thanks.
Any other public comment? Okay, seeing none, we will go to our first presenter, the California Transplant Donor Network.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. My name is Lori Suchek. I'm with the California Transplant Donor Network. I am the supervisor of clinical services at the Transplant Network and live here locally in the county. Just waiting for my PowerPoint here. The California Transplant Donor Network serves 41 counties in California and Northern Nevada. We serve 175 hospitals and 11 million people. Our mission at the California Transplant Donor Network is to save and improve lives through organ and tissue donation for transplantation. We also have core values that we make sure that all our employees abide to, as well as our mission statement. We are a nonprofit organization There are 58 organ procurement organizations in the United States. I'll say OPO for now because organ procurement organization is a mouthful. There are 4 OPOs in California. What we are responsible for is the education of the community and education within the hospitals regarding organ and tissue donation. We are responsible for working with potential donor families, and we are also responsible for facilitating recovery and placement of organs and tissues. And I did forget to say that it is especially nice to be here in April because April is National Donate Life Month. Just a little bit about organ and tissue donation. There are several organs that can be transplanted with each donor, 8 lives can be saved. One donor can donate 2 kidneys, a liver, a pancreas, a heart, 2 lungs, and small intestines. Tissue transplants can save multiple lives through skin grafts, both burn victims and any kind of wounds, soft tissue for sports injuries, and also urinary incontinence. Tissue donation can also help with limb salvage, patients that have cancer or traumatic injury. Tissue donation can also help with joint replacement, three hip, knee, and shoulder replacements, bone reconstruction, spinal and facial. Eye donation can help restore eyesight for patients, and heart valves can be transplanted for recipients so they do not require anticoagulant therapy. So one donor can not only save 8 lives but also enhance 50 people through tissue donation. Just want to talk a little bit about who can be a donor. Generally, organ donors are someone who are in a hospital, someone on a ventilator, and someone who is brain dead. For tissue donations, many more people can be tissue donors because the requirements are similar to a blood donor, but it can be somebody who has had a cardiac arrest, for example, at home, and you can still be a tissue donor even though you cannot donate your organs. Just really quickly, want to talk about brain death because I know sometimes there's some confusion about brain death. It is the irreversible cessation of brain function, including the brain stem, and brain death is death. Sometimes people confuse brain death with coma, and so just some differences. If you are brain dead, you are ventilator dependent. In a coma, you may or may not be ventilator dependent. Someone who is brain dead has no brainstem reflexes. Someone who is in a coma can have some brainstem reflexes intact. Someone who is brain dead is unable to maintain their own vital functions. And in a coma, you can maintain some vital functions. If you are not supported, if a brain dead patient is not supported mechanically, cardiac arrest is unavoidable. Someone in a coma, cardiac arrest or cardiac demise is not certain. Just wanted to talk a little bit about the organ donation process. The first part of the process is identification of a potential donor, and that is where hospitals acknowledge that there's a patient that is severely injured in a hospital and has no chance of survival. The patient is then referred to the appropriate OPO, and a call is made to our organization. An evaluation of the patient is then made, and our transplant coordinators go and evaluate the patient for medical suitability of organs and tissues. And then a donation discussion, if the patient is medically suitable, a donation discussion is held with the family. We provide family support and make sure that the families are fully aware of all the options that they have. Not only do we have transplant coordinators who clinically are there at the hospital, but we have a family services support team who are mostly made up of medical social workers who are there for our families. If a family does consent, then we are responsible for the donor management of the patient. That includes evaluating the organs and tissues, placement of the and recovery of the organs, and then transportation of those organs. And that's about a 48-hour process after brain death is declared. So this is why I'm here, is to talk about the need and get the information out of why organ and tissue donation is so important. There are 18 people that die every day in the United States waiting for a transplant. In the United States, currently, there are more than 110,000 people waiting for organ transplant. In California, there's 21,000. In our service area for CTDN, there's 10,476. And in San Luis Obispo County alone, there's 141 patients on a waiting list for a transplant. This is kind of a confusing slide, but you can just see that California has a lot of people on the list. It lists out which organs and by ethnicity of patients that are on the waiting list. Lives are saved by donors every year. In 2010, 28,664 transplants were done in the United States, and over 2.5 million tissue grafts are done in the United States every year. It sounds like big numbers. There's 2.6 million deaths annually in the United States. Of those, there's almost 250,000 that are potential tissue donors, and only 12 to 15,000 of those patients that die are potential organ donors. So you can see that even though many people die every year, it's a very small percentage that are able to be organ donors. So annually there's about 25,000 actual tissue donors and 7,000 actual organ donors every year. So if all those potential organ donors became actual donors, the waiting list could be not a waiting list anymore. So just people should not be ruling themselves out as a potential donor. Just wanted to talk about some misconceptions and facts. Many people say I'm too old or I'm not healthy enough to be a donor. The fact is anyone can sign up and be an organ donor and can be evaluated as a donor. There's a myth that at the hospital they won't try to save me if they know I'm a donor. The fact is the donor registry is only checked at death. I was an ER nurse for 15 years and never looked at someone's donor card, so it's just not done. There's also misconceptions about religion, and all major religions in the U.S. support organ donation, and also misconceptions about an open casket funeral, and funeral traditions are not affected by donation. Donate Life California Donor Registry. So in 1968, the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act was created, and that's what created the donor card, as most of you are probably familiar with the card that goes on the back of the driver's license. This was a legal mechanism for individuals 18 years and older to document their desire to donate. The act also developed an order of priority of family members who can consent to donation, so a legal next of kin kind of priority list. And that's in the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, in the and that was from the Act of 1968. The donor card is legally binding, but now in 2007, California has updated their Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, and this includes the DMV registration or online registration, and this is also legally binding. A donor can make their anatomical gift by authorizing a statement, and that is imprinted on the driver's license through the individual's driver's license, and that is done at the DMV. The second way is to go directly through the Donate Life California website. If you do designate yourself at the DMV, your name automatically goes onto the Donate Life California website. And here's just information on how to sign up. So in California, the website is www.donatelifecalifornia.org, and you can also go through the DMV. This is what it looks like on your driver's license form. There's a little change as of July 1st of this year. It was unclear before how people could leave it blank on their driver's license. So now there's the choice to either, yes, add my name to the donor registry, or I do not wish to register at this time. And that's a new law that is going to be as an effect as of July 1st. This is just kind of a footprint of what the website looks like. And the number of registrants in California, as you can see, is reached over 8 million since 2007. So our goal is to save and enhance lives by increasing the number of registered donors to 40% of licensed or ID holders in California, and increase the number of registered donors in Nevada. We also have a goal to educate the general public. Another goal is to ask people to make a decision and to sign up on the registry online or through the DMV, and also, very importantly, to talk to families about their decision. I can say from personal experience, when I talk to a family that knows their family's wishes at a time when they're grieving, it's so much easier for them to make a decision if they know what their family would have wanted than to try to guess about that. CTDN does several events throughout the year, and these are just photos of our community outreach events. We participated in the Rose Bowl Parade this year and had a float at the Rose Parade, do community health fairs, and lots of events throughout the year. I'm just going to talk quickly about some of the campaigns that we're involved in to increase the awareness of organ and tissue donation. The first is Adopt a DMV, and this is a campaign where people in the community can volunteer, and they quarterly go into the local DMV office and check to make sure all the information and pamphlets and the posters are up at the DMV. And these are some of the DMV posters that are up. And I was just in there with my 16-year-old son, and I saw it. So somebody's doing it in our community. Health Partners Saving Lives. This is a new campaign this year with posters and informational pamphlets, and we are trying to disperse those in health clinics and physicians' offices to have in the waiting rooms so that patients have access to information about organ and tissue donation and where they can get more information. CTDN has started this year high school campaigns, so presentations in high schools, and the goal for this year is to reach 141, I think, high schools in California. So our Donate Life ambassadors, those are very important to us, and those are volunteers in the community who help us with all the community outreach. And so there's a lot of ways that people can help spreading the word about organ and tissue donation by becoming a volunteer or a Donate Life ambassador. There are also national celebrations out there, the first being April, being National Donate Life Month. In November every year, there's a weekend that is National Donor Sabbath, and you may be at your local church and hear a speaker during that weekend talk about organ and tissue donation. These are just some important links if you need those. And I'm opening up if anybody has any questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's very informative. My question might come under the title of myth busting, or maybe fact providing. In the donor management stage, mm-hmm. is the recipient responsible for all donor costs, or is the donor or the donor's insurance pays for the harvesting of the organs?
Great question, and one that I forgot on the slide. Any cost of donation, once a patient is declared brain dead, the family of the donor patient or the insurance incurs no costs. That's our organization actually then does the costs of the donor management. We get our money just because that's usually the next question that gets asked. So the transplant centers, from their recipients' insurance, pay us. So we have four local transplant centers that we work with, Stanford, Lucile Packard, UCSF, and CPMC. And we also, Medicare, we get some money from Medicare for our kidney recipients.
Thank you for coming to talk to us. I saw in the newspaper this morning an article about HIV, people who are HIV positive, and I think it said right now it's illegal for them to donate, but there are HIV positive people who want an organ and would be happy to take one from someone else who's HIV positive. What do you see about, what's your thought on that issue? Thank you.
Yes, I saw the article this morning as well, and hadn't heard anything about that. I think that HIV is, it's not quite the death sentence that it used to be. There's treatment options out there. People are living a long time. I think that if that's a way to increase the donor pool, if you have an HIV-positive donor, that would go into an HIV-positive recipient. I don't see that being a huge list of patients that are on the list that are HIV positive, but I see it being beneficial. Currently, as an example, we do have hepatitis C donors, and those organs only go to hepatitis C recipients. Yes.
I've heard, I think we've possibly all heard about third world countries in which organ donation is not voluntary, mm-hmm. and I've heard of that in the United States as well, and that's kind of behind the reluctance of some people to have their status known or possibly even on a driver's license. Is there another way to you understand what I mean?
Yeah. Is there a black market or?
And is there another sort of reliable way to be registered other than indicating it on a driver's license?
There's no other way to indicate. There's no. It's illegal for to be a donor rather than having it be from the donor or the donor's family. So consent. If you have not designated yourself on a driver's license, then your family would then be approached at the time, and then they would make that decision.
I have a question regarding the Hep C. Mm-hmm. I know there's been a lot of changes and developments within that. What percentage of people do you think that have Hep C are going to wind up needing an organ transplant?
And that's a good question.
If you could speak to that.
I don't know the percentages. I know that it's not always, people think automatically that it's a liver transplant that those patients need, but sometimes even though they have hepatitis C, their liver is still functioning, but maybe they have kidney failure for another reason. So I can't really speak to the numbers. I know that if someone, the numbers are small, I know, at our local transplant centers of Hep C recipients, because sometimes those patients, when they're donors, were not really able to allocate the organs locally. So I know it's small, but I couldn't give you a number and be accurate on it.
I have one other question, too, and on whether that's a myth or not. If you've undergone chemotherapy, does that keep you from being a donor?
It depends how recent it is, and it's someone who has been cancer-free for several years, we evaluate them. It's all based on the right donor for the right recipient. So sometimes there'll be the right recipient out there for a patient, and so we have to evaluate each case on a case-by-case basis.
Okay, so people who have had cancer may be able to sign up.
Yes.
Whether or not they get used will depend on the
timing
and
yes.
The timing. Okay, great, thank you. Any other questions from commissioners? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Good evening, Health Commissioner, commissioners. My name is Sue Sunderland, and I am a kidney recipient. It will be 9 years in June that I have had my blessing at a second life. It has been such an incredible gift because I was so incredibly sick and sleeping 6 hours a day, and I was at home doing peritoneal dialysis, which is people call self-dialysis. But instead of doing hemodialysis and being hooked up to a machine, you have a solution that with a little shunt in your into the peritoneal cavity, and you put a bag of solution in, which is dextrose and saline, and it dwells around your small intestines, and it through osmosis and dialysis, or not dialysis, osmosis and diffusion, it pulls toxins out of your blood. And there's, you know, around your intestines, you have, you know, many, many, many capillaries. So I would, you know, with peritoneal dialysis, you always have solution in your belly, and it's about 2 liters, which is quite a lot to carry around all the time. So I did what is called an exchange at home 4 times a day. And it's a real, it's basically, you know, you have to be very careful because it is a, you can get an infection very, very easily, but it all works on gravity. So when you're draining, you have the solution goes into a drain bag on the floor. And then when you are refilling, you're hanging it up above. And so it's just all just basic gravity. But I did that for almost, it was a little over 5 years. And I had a friend step forward. I had 3 people offer, and finally the 3rd one was the charm. And she was a very, very good match. And like I say, she did great through surgery, as I did too. And she said that with the surgery that, you know, she'd do it again and she'd give another kidney. And she said, I really can't do that. So she had this necklace made for me, and this is her 2nd kidney that she gave me. So she's doing great. Her kidney function is better. You know, it's within the normal range, even with 1 kidney. And I am just doing, I can't believe it, because it is like having a whole new life ahead of me. And I'm feeling so well and so vibrant and so involved with CTDN and another organization called the Central Coast Kidney Foundation, which is a support group for organ donors. And that in this group, it's really, really grown. I think there's probably about 30 people in it, and it's people with kidneys, people with hearts, people with lungs, and we're just there to help each other. But since I've have my kidney, I can participate, and I'm going out to help educate through the public, through CTDN, and going, being able to give back to the community, and mainly would. So I highly recommend it, and it's, you know, the you know, besides being the having your license, you know, as a potential donor, that you can give a kidney and be a live donor and be, you know, really, really help somebody, and, you know, to regain their life and move forward. And people talk about the immune suppressants, and it, you know, I am on immune suppressants and I am on blood pressure meds, but it's such a small price to pay for your life, you know. So and it takes a while when you're first out of your, you know, after surgery to get everything worked out and figure out what's the best dosage for you for, you know, everything. But it's so much better than doing dialysis in any fashion, and it's truly a gift of life if you can give your kidney. So does anybody have any questions? Yes, is that Gina? Yeah.
You may not be the one to answer this, but I wondered, are there other organs, which most people have in duplicate, that other than kidneys, that can be given by live donors?
I'm not sure. Liver?
Currently, there has been cases where family members have given a portion of their liver, and so, but not anything else. Mm-hmm.
Is there a registry for... or is it sort of the friendship circle or the relative circle for kidney donations?
It's, go ahead.
Yeah, it's really interesting what's happened, because, like, for me, it was friends who came forward and wanted to help me. And, you know, family, it wasn't a possibility in my situation. But something new is happening where I don't know what it's called, Lori, but several people will come forward to donate organs, but they want to donate to someone specifically, and they are not a match. And so they'll get several people lined up to do a switch and, you know. And what is that called? A kidney chain.
Exchange. Actually, we just did one with five different recipients and families at CPMC. It's either earlier this month or late last month. So it was amazing where five people, it's kind of a, I can't fit yours, but you could fit so-and-so, and this one can fit this one. So yeah. a chain of people that donated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next on this is the health agency budget service level reductions for fiscal year 2011 and 12, and we have Mr. Hamm here to give us that report.
Hello. Budget process for us began with the board's policy decision to require the health agency to develop both a status quo budget, a budget based on the premise that we would continue to do all the things we're doing now in terms of staffing levels and our relationships with our contractors, et cetera, at about the same level we are doing it now, and to figure out what that would cost, and then to incrementally reduce that amount by 10% of the amount of general fund support that we receive in the current fiscal year. So those were the broad parameters that resulted in our need to develop service level reductions totaling about $4 million. We did that. We submitted that those budget deliverables to the board, to the CAO, in early February. And the county administrative office began the laborious process of trying to figure out how to work with all of the departments' cut lists to come up with a balanced budget. They concluded that process last week. So we now know essentially where the line has been drawn on our cut list in terms of what the county administrator will be recommending to the Board of Supervisors. It's at $2.6 million of reduced level of general fund support. So I think what you have in your packet includes the summary spreadsheet that includes all of the cut list items, the service level reduction items, including things at the top like behavioral health staff will use voluntary time off to reduce labor costs, public health staff will use voluntary time off, et cetera, going down the list. And the cuts becoming increasingly painful in theory as we go. That was our responsibility at the health agency management level to try to put them in the proper priority, if you will. The Health Commission's Budget Committee met last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago? Two members of the committee anyway. And while I won't speak for the Budget Committee, y'all can chime in. The Budget Committee felt that it would be most appropriate for it to ask the Commission to weigh in to the extent that you choose to do that as a Commission on the items that are that involve reductions in funding to support public health and indigent medical care programs. Not that you can't choose to take up questions or to take a position on matters pertaining predominantly to either animal services or the behavioral health department of the agency. All those items are on the list, and the entire list is before you. But that was the Budget Committee thought that because there are a mental health board and a drug and alcohol advisory board who would traditionally concern themselves with the possible service level reductions in on the behavioral health side of the health agency, and then as animal services is a relatively recent addition to our mix of services, they have their own group of very enthusiastic volunteers who will concern themselves with things like the two animal services items on the cut list, the possible elimination of spay-neuter certificates, and the significant reduction of our health education program. So what I did just as a sort of a summary is lumped those cut list items together. About 10 of them are essentially refinements to expense levels, as the first couple that I mentioned. It's true that when employees agree to take voluntary time off, that that is a reduction in our capacity to do work. But when it happens in a thin amount over a broad range of programs, it's very difficult to quantify the impact in the specific programs in which those employees, environmental health, the various programs in public health nursing, health promotion, healthcare services. So we haven't really attempted to be specific about how that might impact our service level capabilities. And then other adjustments to either expense or revenue. There are, like I said, there are about 10 items. Items 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 13, 18, 28, 32. Those aren't the kind of things that are likely to draw a lot of attention from our stakeholders or from the public, and it's unlikely that the board will find those adjustments difficult to make. There are some cuts that we consider to be in the administrative world, 7, 8, 9, and 30. Administrative assistants, administrative services officer, an accounting technician in our accounts payable group, less money to buy programming and IT support from our IT division. Again, those are not the kind of things that are going to get people very excited in terms of the public or our stakeholders. The public health and indigent medical care items, 14, 15, 16, 17, 19, 20, 22, and 29, I think because of the action that the budget committee took, those were the items that we highlighted for your consideration tonight. And I think what Gene did in sending out the packet was include the narrative impact description of those particular service level reductions so that you would have that information in advance of tonight's meeting. If you want to get into a discussion about those particular items, both Dr. Bornstein and I are here and are happy to respond to specific questions or provide you with additional information about those items. You've heard from Lisa and Mary about Martha's Place specifically. We can talk a little bit more about that if you have questions about Martha's Place, because it was brought up during the public comment period. And I mentioned to them that we'd have an opportunity to talk more about it during this item as an agendized item if you wanted to hear more from them or if you wanted to ask more questions about that. I see Mr. Bacus in the audience, and so we have a CHC rep here. I can tell you where we are with our negotiations with Community Health Centers of the Central Coast on the agreement that we hope to have with them next year. So that's my introductory summary. Happy to address any of the items specifically. I'd take a crack at the indigent medical care items first, if that was okay with you. There are two CHC cut list items. One's characterized as change pharmacy contractor, and the other one is simply a reduction in the grant amount of $500,000. And then you probably noticed reduce hospital, CMSP hospital rate on there as a cut list item. And then for the five or so public health items, I guess what happened between when you got that list and today is the good news. The last four items on the list have fallen below the line. That's very good news for those programs and for the staff that hold those positions and for us. So items 33, 34, 35, and 36, which were the last four items on the list, are no longer being considered for reduction. So where the county administrator was able to recommend funding for the health agency essentially precluded further consideration of those cuts. So I'm happy to respond to questions.
Do you have a report, Lynn, to make from the budget committee?
Oh, well, I think that Mr. Hamm pretty well summarized what we talked about, and the idea was to kind of focus in on those items that were specific to this this commission, and have a discussion if we wanted to with Mr. Hamm here to answer our questions as to any action if any, we want to take in regard to the budget items, or if we want to possibly feel out, you know, what supervisors are thinking, if we could find that out. I mean, 1 year I remember that we did have where we visited the various supervisors and tried to give them our opinions, but we don't necessarily need to do that, but we might want to. That's up to the commission at this point. But the budget committee, that's what the budget committee said, was let's focus on specifically health commission items and have Mr. Hamm here to answer any questions about the service level reductions. What will that mean to us? And he kind of explained that to us as a committee, but I think it's important that.
Does the budget committee have any priority? There's quite a few, of course, to discuss here. Do you have any priority of what you think is tops that we should concentrate on?
We took those items. That was the ones that we were, though, no. So the answer is no. We didn't take those items and then prioritize them. No, we did not.
I think you started out by naming three programs, and the first two were the CHC contract, and the next was the pharmacy contractor, and the third one was something to do with hospital. Which number is that?
20.
Thank you very much. Okay. So it's not highlighted here.
Could you speak to the reduction in the hospital contract rates?
Yeah, we're following the state's lead. The state, as a part of their effort to balance their budget, has suggested reductions in Medi-Cal reimbursement rates. Since the county closed General Hospital, we have attempted to track Medi-Cal payment rates in our contracts with all four hospitals, two CHW hospitals and two Tenet hospitals. We do have two-year agreements with the hospitals, and they're overlapping. In other words, we have two-year agreements with the two Tenet hospitals, and they expire 1 year, and then the next year, the two-year agreements with the two CHW Catholic Healthcare West hospitals expire. And I think the CHW contracts are up for renegotiation at the end of the current fiscal year for what would be a two-year renewal. And it's pretty simple. We intend to approach them as well as the representatives from Tenet and ask them to accept a small reduction as a percentage, a small reduction in the rate that we pay when a CMSP patient requires inpatient hospitalization services, and we hope that a number that will be very small on their budget will be a meaningful reduction on our CMSP expenditures.
I wanted clarification. I think I heard you say that it ended up 2.6 million was all that had to be cut.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Okay. And so that's how we were able to drop the last four off the list.
That's right.
Okay. Nevertheless, the last figure I see here is for 2,700,000. It's close, but so what's
the last item is a revenue. It's an increase in revenue. The sheriff through some special pots of money under his discretion is transferring $100,000 to the health agency to offset basically most of the cost of a mental health therapist at the jail. So I think that item, number 32 is one of the ones that the last one I included in my list of what I call expense or revenue refinements. It's an adjustment to our revenue. Mm-hmm. It's actually not revenue. It's an intra-fund transfer in from the sheriff's office to the health agency, both general fund budgets. But it increased our purchasing. It replaced general fund support with a transfer of funds from the sheriff's office.
Okay. So I need clarification as to how these figures work, because here's $100,000 coming from the sheriff.
Right.
And yet it's listed in the revenue reduction column. And then there are other amounts with the in parentheses in that column.
Yeah, those would be reductions.
Those are the real reductions.
Well, for example, when you see a negative number in the revenue column, like number 28, loss of first five grant to Martha's Place. We budgeted in our status quo budget, we assumed that we would receive $150,000 from the first five commission to help offset the continued operation of the cost of Martha's Place, and found out between then and now that we believe the first five commission is going to provide zero in a grant amount to the health agency to offset the cost of Martha's Place. So we had to reduce revenue by $150,000, so it's a bracketed or negative number in the revenue column. A positive number in the revenue column reflects an increase of revenue, for example, the, as you mentioned, the additional sheriff's funding. Believe me, the numbers add up correctly.
I'm not questioning your addition. It's just spreadsheets are not my business, Mr. Hamm. So,
the 150 in the sheriff's column is a good thing. The 150,000 in the Martha's Place column is a bad thing.
So I have a question on that then. Did the first five commission, have they had dramatic reductions?
I'm going to refer that to Dr. Bornstein because she's a member of the first five commission. I'm not.
Yes, first five is anticipating from the current fiscal year to the next fiscal year a 42% reduction in its funding, so very significant. And that is based in large part on a spending plan that acknowledged that if First Five wanted to survive out for another decade or so, they were going to spend their trust fund resources in a slower fashion. With the passage of one of the budget bills at the state level, it won't affect next year directly, but the billion-dollar collective give-back from First Five commissions across the state will impact First Five going in the out years. The commission, however, decided not to take further reductions in the immediate future, as in next year, but to deal with that problem down the road. But there will be, that's a long-winded answer to, yes, a more than 40% reduction in program fund support from the current year to next year is envisioned from the first five.
On the contract with the Community Health, it's a reduction of $500,000. Is that right?
Actually, I'd recommend that the commission take a look at it as if those two items, one was a one's listed as a $500,000 reduction in clinical services, and the other is a $300,000 that's called change of pharmacy contractor. Think of those two as one thing for now.
So what is the grant for next year recommended? How much is it?
Well, the budget, as recommended, includes $2.2 million.
It's $2.2 million.
Right.
And then in reading this, I thought you were attempting to go to a fee-for-service.
Well, let me give you the CHC summary. Last year, as we were going into the current fiscal year, when we were talking with CHC management, Ron and Larry and others, about what had happened and what was likely to continue to happen, the idea, now that we had gotten from $5.2 million, which was the peak of funding in, I think, 07, 08, or 08, 09. Anyway, it peaked at 5.2, and then it's ratcheted down since then, 4.9, 3.6, 5, 3 million in the current fiscal year. Together, we came up with the idea that, well, maybe now that we're at $3 million, it's time to start thinking about this in a different way than the grant that had been envisioned from the beginning. And so the idea of a fee-for-service arrangement came up. Both sides thought, well, maybe it's time for that. And so we began to think of it in those ways. We've been in discussions with CHC for several months already now, this budget development cycle, initially, we offered a relatively low per-encounter amount. They responded back with, we think you should pay us the federally guaranteed PPS, prospective payment system, full cost rate. We said we couldn't afford to pay you full costs. We were looking for something closer to something that would cover their variable costs and contribute a small amount to their fixed costs so they wouldn't lose money. But so we've been moving in a little bit closer to one another. And the most recent counterproposal from CHC suggested that if we weren't going to be willing to pay them their PPS rate, that maybe we should stop talking about a fee-for-service arrangement and see if we could come to an agreement on a continuation of the grant. And they offered to, they gave us a counteroffer with a specific amount, but at the same time proposed a change in how CMSP patients would access their clinic system that would limit to one clinic in San Luis Obispo where CMSP patients could go. So we are in active negotiations. They are suggesting changes that they think will help them control costs. We, of course, are trying to find a way to reach somewhere in the middle. We very seriously interested in continuing to contract with them. Obviously, they are the safety net provider in the community, 9 clinic sites. The CMSP patients are a relatively small percentage of their total volume of patients, but they clearly also provide access to all the other low-income, unsponsored population in the community. And they're the provider. They're the only provider. And I'm optimistic that we're going to find a way to reach an agreement with them, hopefully something close to what's in the budget.
Which is $2.2 million.
Yes, that's right.
I have some concerns around that. If we're going to be reducing CHC's contract and reducing the hospital contract rates for CMSP, and it seems like the way the economy is going, we're going to have more people needing those resources. You know, who's looking out for the indigent? And that's my concern. We're cutting at that very low level for the people that are the most vulnerable.
Well, clearly, we will only succeed in our discussions with the hospitals if we can find a number that we agree upon. And we will certainly ensure that all 4 hospitals continue to remain as contract providers for the county for CMSP patients. And so the dollar amount is a relatively small amount compared to the total of what we spend on hospital care. We're not going to compromise the safety net in terms of access to hospital care for those patients for whom we have a legal obligation. So I would say don't worry about that. In terms of the CHC arrangement, there's no question that it has evolved since the good times before the recession and when the county had the money to spend. And the grant at $5 million, $5 million plus, was, I'm not going to try to characterize it and quantify it, but it was substantially more than it would have cost us had we been only concerning ourselves with the medically indigent adults for whom we have a legal obligation. So just like the federal government's policy for federally qualified health centers, the federal government ensures that FQHC clinics receive full cost reimbursement for those patients who are Medi-Cal. And at full cost, the federal government is providing a subsidy that allows FQHC clinic systems to provide care to folks who are unsponsored and for whom they receive little or no remuneration. So we've asked CHC's CFO in the past for those 30 or 35,000 patient encounters a year who fall in the self-pay and sliding fee scale category for whom there is no payer, how much money are you receiving on a per encounter basis? And we've been told something in the order of $20 an encounter. That's when people are paying out of their pocket. Those are the people who benefit from the existence of the safety net, in addition to the medically indigent adults who are the individuals for whom the county is legally obligated. And so your issue about, the safety net is an absolutely legitimate policy question, no doubt. The question before the county is, can it afford, and the board will makes this decision every year, that's what they do, to what extent can the county afford to put money on the table in its grant relationship with CHC that it goes above and beyond what it would cost if we were limiting our obligation to those individuals for whom we are obligated under Section 17,000 of the Welfare and Institutions Code. That's a smaller group. So it's an entirely legitimate policy question. And when the county is, like all other local public agencies, state agencies, when we can talk about the federal government, there's a gap between our means of financing and our financing needs, our financing uses. And the board asks for lists from everyone. We're diligent about producing them and sharing them with the board, and the board will do their job and make the decisions that only they can make.
Okay. But did you hear me?
I did.
Okay. Do I have to say it again?
Yes.
Okay. What I'm trying to understand is what percentage of the county budget is the public health department and what percentage of the cuts is it taking? In other words, is it if it's 10% of the budget, is it taking 10% of the cuts or?
Very good question, and I'm sorry I don't have the numbers. I can tell you, though, that we are, as an agency, not just the public health department, but the behavioral health department as well, are being asked to take a disproportionate reduction in terms of where the board is able to spend its discretionary general fund support. Now, the health agency is, I think, the health agency and the Department of Social Services are the two biggest departments. We, and again, I don't have these numbers off the top of my head either, but I think our total expenditures are down to $75 million or something like that. Our general fund support in the current fiscal year is $17.2 million. That's going to go down. But I keep thinking about down from the status quo, and I don't even know how much it is down from this year's budget. I should have that number too, but I don't know that off the top of my head. The reason that the health agency and the road fund were given larger targets is because of the notion that the board has been investing in the form of an overmatch over the years more in health agency programs than they are required to by the funding formulas that have historically existed between the state and local governments. So that is a characterization that we actually enjoy in this county, having been the beneficiary of, I don't want to call it extra, mm-hmm. but a higher level of discretionary general fund support than maybe some other counties our size in California benefited from. The downside of that is that when the county is struggling financially in our peer counties where they're not getting that level of discretionary overmatch general fund support, there isn't anything to take away because they're not putting any extra in. In this county, where historically the board has found itself in a position to continue to support financially the very valuable programs that we offer, then in years when the county is the financially strained entity, I mean, the state budget, as messed up as it is, with $12 billion of cuts and $12 billion of revenue extensions or enhancements that's teetering, we really weren't harmed. Health agency programs didn't take a big hit from the $12 billion of cuts. We lost a little bit here and there, and Penny knows those numbers better than I do. But it's the problem for us is not so much the state funding on which we rely is being reduced. I think they pretty much have already done almost everything they can to those programs on both sides. We have some risk on the behavioral health side associated with this realignment idea that's percolating in Sacramento that isn't going to work if they don't get those tax extensions approved. Counties aren't going to go along if we're not assured by a constitutional amendment associated with the vote on the tax extensions, that there would be funds following the new responsibilities that the county would pick up under this new realignment idea. But the challenge for us is not state funding in this budget development cycle. It's county, it's discretionary county general fund support.
On the mental health side, when you include the Mental Health Services Act with the rest of the mental health, then it's pretty close to traditional funding, general fund.
Yeah, if you look back over the last 3 years, David, I think that certainly a lot of the reductions that we've made on the behavioral health side in general fund supported programs have been made up by MHSA.
So it's almost back to what traditionally.
Right.
Right. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for coming in, Mr. Hamm. I have several other questions. I hope you'll bear with me. One of them is, I talked to Eric Greening. He's on the Water Resources Advisory Committee. And he said that Richard Lichtenfels from the Environmental Health Department came in and told them that there's going to be a draft of the biosolids ordinance by summer. And yet this sheet says proposing to suspend all funding for that project. So did someone not tell Mr. Lichtenfels what's going on, or what is going on? So that's the question.
I think that the loss of capacity to work on the biosolids ordinance is a cut that was associated with item 33, which at the time Rich was talking might have been when we weren't sure where the line was going to be drawn. So in terms of environmental health positions and cuts, there are two. Higher up is a reduction. Item number 22 is a reduction of an environmental health specialist from full-time to half-time. And I think the biosolids ordinance is not. Are you looking at it, Penny? It's not on the list of things that are likely to be affected by that half-time reduction. There's a particular employee who is actually looking forward to working half-time that is likely to be the person who, and I think when we had to get further down the list, when we had to go back to environmental health and say, well, what about one more environmental health specialist? That's the one where there were a lot of general fund supported activities that would have to be curtailed or suspended if we had to make that cut, including work on the biosolids ordinance, and that's now below the line.
Okay, the new call. Says D.
Service. directly? They'll pay.
The infant. records.
On support. corrections.
Done this.
certain items.
Try to but
in
and that we would like such, but care.
another thing. Be full. At you heard. online.
Cases.
With all the
we've got roughly
nominating committee. Very concerned.
time they were.
Is involved.
Maybe it's time.
And working.